men around. I glanced around for inspiration. Mrs. Gibbs makes her own milk deliveries now, and Mrs. Quail has taken on the role of bus driver, like a lot of us taking on new jobs. The war's mixed everything else up. Why shouldn't it change the choir, too? A few claps went round, as well as one or two cheers of, "Hear, hear, and that's the spirit." I still couldn't believe I'd stood up and spoken, and to Mrs. B as well, who was watching me in a highly disapproving way. "Indeed, Mrs. Tilling," Mrs. B snipped. "I don't know which part of that address shocks me the most. The notion of having to lower our moral standards because of the war, or the fact that you, my dear, seem to have joined the fray." She turned to the group clustered on the altar between the two choir stalls. "We will end this once and for all with a show of hands. Whoever agrees with this preposterous notion, please raise your hand." Now, Mrs. B is not a spirited loser. Even as she counted and recounted the hands that went up, an indignant frown took form. She glowered at us as if we were somehow beyond reproach. "Don't think this won't have its consequences. I'll be watching. Carefully." And with that she huffed off, making a great show of it, and then, not being able to quite leave, plonked herself down in the last pew. She obviously felt she could guilt us into changing our minds, but as the voices around me grew, I knew she had no such chance. "What a jolly idea," Hattie said. "I can't think why we didn't come up with it before." "Yes, and such a splendid name, too," Venetia declared. "The Chilbury Ladies' Choir. It has a ring about it." I hadn't thought of it before, but now I found myself wondering why we'd been closed down in the first place, why the vicar had so much say over us, and more to the point, why we'd simply let him do it. Prim passed around some copies of Be Thou My Vision. "Let's get ourselves organized. Stand in your usual places in the choir stalls, or wherever you'd like to be, and try to sing along with your part." We muddled around, and Mrs. B huffed into the altos beside me. "I need to be here to see what a mess she's going to make of the whole thing." "It'll be fine," I said. But I was holding my breath, praying that we'd do well. I didn't want it to fall through right from the start. For Prim to be disheartened by our terrible voices. We needed to show her that this could work. With a look of confidence on her face, Prim lifted her baton, looked to Mrs. Quail to begin the introduction, and then brought us in. The sound of our voices filling the space, echoing through the little stone church, brought a burst of joy inside of me. The thrill of singing as a group again, the soft music of intertwining voices, for once staying in tune. I wondered if everyone was putting in a little more effort, trying to make this work. "That was wonderful," Prim gushed, when the final tapering of the last notes ebbed away into the still air. "We've got some talented singers here." We all smiled and hoped she was talking about us. Even Mrs. B's little group seemed to come under the spell of the music, forgetting the objections. Mrs. B, however, wasn't ready to give up the fight. "I'll have to speak to the vicar about this," she announced, and flounced down the altar and out of the double doors. "I'll hear soon enough how that goes." Afterwards, I wandered home in a trance, trapped between the euphoria of song and the pinpricks of fear reminding me that David is leaving soon. The Nazis invaded Norway last week, and we're sending a force to try to push them out. I hope they don't send David there. Slowly, softly, I began to sing to myself, "Be Thou My Vision." Everything was black in the moonless night, the blackout rules forcing all the light out of the world. But with a cautious smile, I realized that there are no laws against singing. And I found my voice becoming louder, in defiance of this war. In defiance of my right to be heard.
Kitty Winthrop's Diary. Thursday, 18th of April, 1940. What a breathtaking day! My first singing lesson with the superb and masterful Prim took place at her house on Church Row at 5 o'clock. I have never been more excited and arrived a whole 10 minutes early, waiting for her to get back from the university. Prim arrived on her bicycle, her cloaked body balancing precariously on the narrow frame.
"You're here early," she chortled. "I always say that enthusiasm paves every path with a shining light."
She climbed off and leant the bicycle against the front of the house.
"Come in and we'll make some tea before we start."
The small house was exactly the same size and shape as Hattie's, except it was completely filled with extraordinary things and smelt as musty as an antique shop. In the corner, a gold elephant stood on his hind legs. On the wall above were paintings of distant mountain peaks and the burnt oranges and reds of a desert sunset. A small table was crammed with decorated boxes of different shapes and sizes, covered with shells or brightly coloured silks, peacock blue, emerald green, cerise.
"Open one," she said as she watched my eyes flitting over everything.
I picked up an emerald one with a gold-coloured cord. There was a small latch that opened it, and inside the black velvet interior was a tiny silver ring, a child's, with a St. Christopher motif on the front. "Was this yours?" I asked hesitantly.
"Yes," she laughed. "It was given to me when I was a child. It came from India, where I grew up. India has always been my favourite place. The colours, the noise, the vibrancy, the people."
She pointed to a picture of a beautiful white temple on the wall beside her.
"We lived close to this majestic edifice, the Taj Mahal. It's a mausoleum built by an emperor for his wife, who died in childbirth. He visited here every day, it is said, to grieve."
"Can you imagine loving someone so much that you create such a wonderful building?"
"Well," she said, "it depends how rich and powerful one happens to be, I expect. Most people wouldn't be able to afford it. But that doesn't make one's love any less.
We can show our grief in simpler ways. Is not the beauty and power of funeral song just as great as such a palace?" I nodded, peering into the sitting room that was beaming with the brightness of antiquities. "Do all of these things come from India?"
"Not at all. I travelled across Asia. There's a mesmerizing world out there where people live in all kinds of different ways."
She led the way into the room so that I could see. Gold gleamed from every corner. Gold urns, gold statues, gold silk drapes around the windows, tiny gold miniatures as small as my thumb, an elephant, an old woman, a falcon.
"Other cultures are rather odd, don't you think?" I said.
"No, quite the contrary. Other cultures often make me think that we're the strange ones."
She chuckled to herself, then headed for the kitchen.
"Let's make some tea."
As the kettle boiled, I looked around. A series of old decorated jugs sat on the windowsill, and bunches of dried herbs lined the far wall, giving off scents of rosemary, thyme and lavender. A waist-high seagull watched us from the corner.
"Oh, that's Ernest, made of papier-mâché," she chirped. "He was one of the props for a play we put on in London years ago. He's always here in the morning looking hungry."
I laughed and gave him a pat on the head. Around the sink were a number of bottles full of liquids and powders and potions, and I leapt back. Was Prim a witch? She saw me stare and smiled.
"Those are my medicines," she said. "I once was very ill indeed, and I need the medicine to prevent me from getting ill again."
I stood back looking at her. She looked pretty normal.
Well, normal in a kind of witchy way.
"It's not catching, is it?"
"No, I caught it from a nasty mosquito in India, but we don't have mosquitoes here."
She rearranged the bottles, then made the tea.
"The disease is called malaria."
"Were you terribly ill?"
"It was almost the end of me. I was about the same age as your sister, my whole life ahead of me with plenty of music and laughter, and romance too. There was a boy whom I was to marry. She smiled at the distant memory of him. He was the most beautiful creature, a butterfly collector, brilliantly clever.
Why didn't you marry him?
He died, she said simply. He contracted malaria at the same time as me, and didn't make it. We'd grown up as neighbours and then fell in love. We became ill at the same time. But the malaria ran its course and passed out of me. I was alive.
But broken-hearted?
Exactly, and ever since then I've felt destined to live a double life, for both me and my butterfly collector. Alone, yet not. She found a floral porcelain sugar bowl and milk jug. It taught me that you have to live your own life. Don't let anyone hold you back. I found myself blurting out,
I want to be a singer, but Daddy insists that I can't. He wants me to make a good marriage, to be a good wife. But Mama tells me to take care when choosing a husband, or my life will be a misery.
You need to make your own path, she said, leading the way into the back room. Decide what you want to do, and then all you have to do is work out how to achieve it. The room was full of musical instruments. There was a huge harp, an upright piano, a harpsichord, a stand with a clarinet, and a silver piccolo lying across the table like a fairy had just flown off after doing a spot of practice. Prim perched the tray on a tiny round table and pulled over the piano seat, gesturing for me to sit on the harpsichord chair.
Is that why you never married? Do you still love the butterfly collector?
I don't know. She smiled, pouring out the tea. Sometimes we do things without fully understanding. You shouldn't try to know everything, Kitty. Often it's beyond our comprehension. She put the teapot back on the tray. Now, before we start, I want you to sing me a note as clearly as you can.
I sang a long, high, la.
Beautiful, she said, picking up the cup and saucer again and handing it over to me. Did you think about that too much before singing?
No,
I said, sipping the hot tea. Sometimes the magic of life is beyond thought. It's the sparkle of intuition, of bringing your own personal energy into your music.
But don't I need to worry about singing the right words to the right notes?
The most important part of singing is the feeling.
She leant forward.
Remember, Kitty, I have faith in you.
That afternoon we sang Ave Verum Corpus by Mozart, my favourite composer. I sang better and stronger than I ever have before.
There is a tragic tale about Mozart, she told me. He wrote his Requiem, one of the saddest funereal pieces ever written, as he himself was dying, telling his wife, I fear I am writing a requiem for myself. On the eve of his death, he and some friends sang it together, and it was at the most poignant song of his requiem, the Lacrimosa, that he let the papers drop and began to weep for his very own death. He died in the early morning. Can you imagine writing your own death music? I gasped.
That's dreadful. Do you think the music made him die?
Perhaps it was that he knew deep down inside that he was dying, and put that fear into the music. She looked back at the Ave Verum Corpus. Why don't you try this again, just like before, only this time? Think about Mozart writing for his own death. Put your heart into it. She began the introduction, and I felt the sound of my voice come from deep inside. And I found myself thinking of the fear you must feel before you die. A strange elation came over me when I'd finished, like I was a pure white dove's feather being whooshed up into the air by the lightness of the breeze. And later, as I wandered home, I drew a deep breath of the crisp spring air, and I felt suddenly jubilant to be alive.
Letter from Miss Edwina Poult.
directory to her sister Clara, 3 Church Row, Chilbury, Kent. Friday, 19th of April, 1940. Dear Clara, a large pile of crisp £100 notes is now hidden in a secret hole under my floorboards, wrapped in an old envelope and done up neatly with a piece of string knotted twice. In less than a month, the deed will be done, the money will be double, and we can away, you and I, to our new life in Burnham Wood. Yesterday I met the Brigadier for the exchange. The bundle of money gripped firmly in his sinewy fingers, the tight old git. To say he was reluctant to hand it over would be putting it mild, but I finally wrenched it away and fled, the money safe in my hands. That was the easy part. Now I have to deliver the boy. You see, much to my infuriation, Mrs. Dawkins from the farm gave birth last Friday. I wanted to push its scrawny head back in, but then I saw that it was a girl, so it wouldn't have been any good anyway. Now, my hopes are pinned on Goody Two-Shoes Hattie. She's due a week after Mrs. Winthrop, so at least I won't have any issues with early births. Problem is, the Tilling woman's hovering around like a bleeding fairy godmother. Now she's gone and promised to be midwife at the birth, even though I tried to talk Hattie out of it. I mean, who would take a misery like Mrs. Tilling instead of an experienced, well-equipped professional like myself? But she was adamant, whining that Mrs. Tilling was the closest to family that she has in a pathetically sentimental way. God damn the girl! Unspeakable as it was, I decided to befriend the nauseating Tilling woman. I had to persuade her out of it or find out when she'd be out of town. If all else fails, I could give her a major injury, push her down some stairs or collide into her with my bicycle. I hadn't wanted to go that route, frankly. There's a fine line between a broken arm and manslaughter, after all. As a first effort, I joined the new choir to cozy up next to her, and I couldn't believe my luck when I walked in and spotted a place right beside her. "I'm surprised to see you here, Miss Pawtry," she said snootily, shuffling over. "It's not often we see you in church." "I always come on Sundays," I smiled warmly, although I bet she's the type to count and see who's absent. There was a lot of kerfuffle about starting a women's choir, which was patently ridiculous. Of course women can sing without men. I do it every week in the bath. Then we sang some rather dreary hymns, and after practice was over, I saw my chance. "I feel it my duty, Mrs. Tilling, to lighten your load and take over Hattie's birth," I began. "I live next door to her, after all, and you're so incredibly busy these days. I have all the equipment and medicines at my house should anything happen. I even have a mechanical ventilator," I lied. "What, in your own home?" Mrs. Tilling frowned with disbelief. "Did the hospital lend it to you?" "Yes, that's it," I said, quick as a fox, hoping she wouldn't check. "You'd be surprised how often I need it to get the baby breathing proper. First-time pregnancies can be hazardous, you know."
"But you're busy too, and Hattie's made her mind up to have me there."
"I may be busy, but duty first," I bounced back. "I feel a responsibility deep down inside." I thrust a fist up against my heart at this point, looking all patriotic. "And if anything should happen, I'd feel tormented for the rest of my days." I tried to push out a few tears at this point, but there's only so much you can do.
"Quite,"
Mrs. Tilling said, stepping back, a look of distaste on her lips. I sensed that she smelt something fishy. I must have overdone the theatrics, so I quickly changed tack. "But you do so much for our little community, what with the WVS always helping people out, all this on top of your own nursing duties."
"Yes, the WVS is a great force. You should join. There's a meeting in Lichfield a fortnight from today, distributing the bundles for Britain from America. Why don't you come along and see how it works?"
I smiled a gleeful smile, as that was precisely what I was looking for. A date when the Tilling woman would be out of town, and perfect timing too, a day before Mrs. Winthrop's due date, and a week before Hattie's.
"Is it an all-day event?" "Yes, all day Friday the 3rd of May."
She looked slightly bemused at my enthusiasm, so I stopped smiling and added with my usual despondency, "I'll have to check my dates, but I'll try to come."
Fortunately, Kitty descended on her with ludicrous cheers for the new choir, so I scooped up my bag and fled, dashing home before my elation exploded. What a stroke of luck! Now all I have to do is check that she keeps her WVS meeting and hone my plan for the births. I have become quite the professional, you see, Clara. My herbal potion brings babies out with impressive speed. Now, to give the potion to Mrs. Winthrop, who is a timid, compliant sort of woman, will be no problem. This is her fourth baby, so I expect the baby to pop out within the hour. After calling out that it's a boy, I'll pretend the baby's not breathing proper, that I need to whisk it to my house for resuscitation with a mechanical ventilator. Who's to know I haven't got one? Hattie, however, will be a more difficult matter. Not only will it be gruelling to get her to take the potion as she is so nauseatingly proper, but then it'll take 4 or 5 hours to get the baby out, it being her first child. Meanwhile, I'll need someone to watch the Winthrop child. That's why I decided to enlist the Winthrop's maid, Elsie. Not only could she lend a sense of propriety by coming with me when I whisk off the Winthrop's baby, but she could also help look after the mite while I'm busy with Hattie. So when I spotted her in the shop yesterday, I invited her for tea and mentioned that I may be in need of her assistance at the birth. What you're saying is you want me to come and help with Mrs. Winthrop's birth and then come to your house if you have to take the baby away for emergency help? She screwed her eyes up with distaste, suspecting it was down and dirty business. But she didn't ask questions, came from a background like that, see? Ask no questions, take the money, leg it. That's right, love, I said, offering her another biscuit. I just need someone to help me look after the baby for a short while. She took 2 biscuits, and I could see her thinking it through, her beautiful face pondering like a deer listening for danger. I could do it, she said at last, but how much will you give me? I'd give you 10 bob for your trouble, provided you kept quiet. 10 bob, she uttered. More like 10 quid, I'd say. 5 quid, then, I said. What a pain this girl was being. Oh, all right, then, she said, getting up. I'd love to get me own back on that cheating bastard, even if it's just his family. You're worth 1,000 of him, Elsie, I said, leading her to the door. You need to find yourself a proper gentleman.
Yes, perhaps I will.
She poked her head out the door and looked up into the puffy grey clouds.
You just wait. I'll find someone far better than that scoundrel.
Then she darted out, her long, slim form gracefully flitting through the droplets of rain, and I settled back to my plan with relish. This will work, sister. I wish you'd stop pestering me with your doubts. I have no time to think about whether it's right or wrong, and who cares anyway? How can I think of all that morality nonsense when we've got a chance to get back to where we belong, safe and free? I shall let you know when the deed is done. Keep hush, as usual. Edwina.
Sylvie's Diary. Saturday, 20th of April, 1940. Kitty told me to write a diary. It is good for my English. I have to write about our house. It is big and grand. Mrs. Winthrop is quiet. Nanny Godwin is old. Kitty is nice but a bit bossy. Venetia is my friend. Brigadier Winthrop is very angry. There is a grumpy maid and a strange butler who has a hump. The new baby is nearly here. I hope they will still want me then. There is a new choir and I am a soprano. Singing is good. Kitty helps me with the words. I like the horses, too. Amadeus is my favorite. I fell off at Bull's End Brook last week. Mr. Slater helped me walk home. He is the man Venetia likes. He spoke a little Czech. It was terrible. My English is much better. Kitty Winthrop's Diary. Tuesday, 23rd of April, 1940. David Tilling's Leaving Party. Tonight, Mrs. Tilling was throwing a party for David. He's back from training and heading to the front in France tomorrow. But I was much more focused on Henry, who was on 48-hour leave from his aerodrome. One has to take advantage of these moments if one has eternal happiness in mind. I spent the afternoon perfecting my appearance. Floating around in Venetia's lilac chiffon dress, I knew I would be the focus of everyone's attention. People would say, "Is that Kitty? Who would have known she'd be so beautiful?" And, "She puts Venetia quite in the shade." Henry would watch from afar, unable to tear his eyes away. Then, when the music started, he would take me in his arms and express the endless depths of his love. Well, maybe it wouldn't happen exactly like that. There might not be dancing after all. But I was determined that this was the night that would secure our future together. "The dress is too big," Sylvie muttered when I asked her how I looked. I'd already padded myself up a little on top, but decided to throw an extra stocking down each one, just to be on the safe side. "That's better," I said, smoothing down the dress in front of the mirror. "He won't be able to resist me, don't you think?" Sylvie sighed. "I think he likes Venetia." I laughed. "Sylvie's definitely coming out of her shell a bit more, but I don't know where she'd get some of her ideas. I'm far more interested in hearing about her secret, and badger her to tell me all the time. But she just goes quiet and runs off. Venetia wanted to make a late entrance, so she stayed behind, as did Daddy, who was tied up with work. "Norway is going horribly wrong," he says. "The Nazis are walking all over us, and it looks like we might have to back out fast. Everyone's worried they'll invade Belgium and France next. Although apparently we have all routes covered, so we should be fine." So it was only Mama, Sylvie and I who plunged into the cool evening air. We beamed our torches around because it's scary walking down the lane next to Pease Potter Wood. Just as we were saying that you never know who might be lurking in there was a crunch of bracken. And who should appear but Proggatt? He shook himself off, bid us good evening and headed back to the house. How very odd! We pressed on. As Mama is incredibly pregnant now, Sylvie and I had to take an arm on each side to help her along, which made it rather jolly. The sky was curdled with dimples of darkening dusk, and apart from the odd hoot of a barn owl, it was silent, like we were treading into an enchanted land. Tiny threads of pollen dusted the air, the sweetly scented yellow specks plunging me into a reminder of last summer, before this beastly war, when everything was just right, as it should be. The Tillings' home, Ivy House, is one of my favourite places in the village. Not as imposing as Chilbury Manor, nor as ornate as Brampton Hall. It has a quiet serenity about it, a flavour of Mrs. Tilling's thoughtfulness lacing itself through the fairy tale gardens, the tiny rosebuds growing over a series of pagodas, and a bird bath and feeder, as Mrs. Tilling loves all living creatures. She now has 6 hens for eggs, and a healthy vegetable patch to help the war effort. Ivy House used to be the vet's office before Dr. Tilling died 10 years ago, and there is still an air of purpose around the place, as if, at its very heart, it remains a haven for lost or harmed creatures. As we opened the front door, a lively throng surged out into the garden, and we hurried in to avoid blackout fines. Mrs. B dishes them out like a strict schoolmarm. Even if only a smidgen of light is let out for a split second, she'll slap a fine in your hand and bellow, "We don't want the Jerrys to see us, do we?" Inside, the house was merry with flickering candles and jaunty music, which sat oddly with the dreadful fear that David might not come back. Red, white and blue bunting was draped across the walls, probably borrowed from Mrs. B after the extravaganza she threw for Henry. The crowd of chattering villagers stood around gossiping, each clutching a rationed-out glass of sherry. Venetia made her grand entrance not long after we'd arrived, bringing the room to a standstill by loudly proclaiming, "I hope I'm not late." Standing out from the rest of us, she was wearing a dress of glistening green and gold, twirling it this way and that so that the sequins caught the light, trailing around her legs with a tempting fluidity. Within an instant, there was a crowd of men surrounding her, mostly friends of David's on their way to war. She rewarded each with her special flirty attention, all pouty lips whispering little secrets into their ears. I wondered if I could craftily trip her up. Before long, Mrs. Tilling hushed us, sending a wave of shushes around the room, and went to fetch David down from his room. We cheered as he came in, dressed in full-pressed khaki uniform, looking terribly grown up. But as I watched, I realised with a flash of both relief and worry that he was still the same David. Relief that a uniform doesn't change a person, then worry that the clumsy lad was going to the front line. He was still the same foolish 9-year-old who'd got stuck up the cherry tree on the green, the same lanky 12-year-old who I'd punched for pulling my pigtails, the same idiot 14-year-old who'd crashed the Dawkins's tractor into a perfectly innocent hedge. His colour is yellow, although not for cowardice, but rather a kind of blindness to reality. And I couldn't help but worry for him. Even now, the eager and dazed look in his eyes showed the way he embraced every challenge in life, with a tireless naivety, like a fox gambling into the hunt, half expecting to be caught, not thinking about how it all might end. "Wow!" he gasped as he came into the glistening sitting room. "You shouldn't have gone to so much effort." He put his arm around Mrs. Tilling in his chaotically warm way. "Thank you for coming, everyone." He stepped forward to us. "Lovely to see you, Mrs. B. I thought you'd be far too busy giving someone what for. Have you persuaded Mr. Churchill to come and give the Chilbury WVS a speech yet? Betty doesn't know he has his top fan club here." Everyone laughed and someone called, "He will do soon enough." David then turned to Venetia, taking her hand and kissing it. "And the beautiful Venetia, a last sight of you to cherish on my journey." His eyes remained on her as his smile lurched wetly. Venetia was all modesty, looking up at him with fluttering eyelashes and glossy red lips. "David, you'll come back my hero," she said in a voice breaking with tears. I wanted to laugh, until I met Mrs. Tilling's sour look from across the room. "We all know Venetia doesn't care a farthing for David. I have no idea why she insists on playing stupid games with him." Mrs. Tilling asked me to offer around a plate of rather chewy cheese straws. With so many rations, no one ever knows what people put into recipes these days. So I mingled around, watching Henry, who was talking to a very pregnant Hattie. He was looking terrifically handsome, with his sandy hair cropped in his pristine RAF uniform. His new moustache is devilishly dashing, like all the best fighter pilots. It makes his nose look a little less beaky, I think. And he looks older, too, even though he's already 19. A real man. Someone who'll know how to take care of me. He didn't seem to notice me watching, until Hattie drew me over to join them. "What a gorgeous dress, Kitty," she said, fingering the fabric. "Don't you think so, Henry?"
"Yes, indeed. You look lovely, Kitty,"
he said, grinning, and I found myself dissolving into his eyes. But then he added,
"You'll follow in your sister's footsteps soon and become quite the beauty."
His eyes swept over to Venetia, who was holding forth in a crowd of men beside the piano. Why does she feel she has to get the attention of every man in the room, including Henry, when she's not even interested in any of them? "I don't want to look like her," I said, annoyed, making him look back to me. "I want to be a beauty in my own right." I felt Hattie let out a sigh. I have no idea why.
"Of course you're a beauty in your own right, Kitty,"
Henry declared jovially, putting his hand warmly on my upper arm and giving me a special smile. I felt a surge of heat where he touched me, like a flame lighting up my body. I waited for him to take me in his arms. But suddenly I felt his attention melt away. Venetia was approaching. Her dress fluttered as she twirled from one man to the next, like a dazzling dragonfly soaring around in search of prey. Her blonde hair hung low over her pearly white shoulders, while a stream of pungent perfume oozed from her soft white neck. Henry's hand lost contact with my arm, which suddenly felt cold and lost. And when I looked up at him, he had turned to face her. "Come and sit down with me, Henry darling, and tell me all about your bombing raids," she chanted loudly, scrolling her fingertips under his chin and softly directing his mouth towards her carefully painted lips. "I hear you've been fighting over Norway."
"I thought you were busy with the other men," he said under his breath.
"They don't mean a thing to me," she said, pouting. Then she leant her head to one side, her thick blonde hair forming a shimmering curtain to conceal her from the rest of the room, and she whispered something into his ear, her long red fingernails barely touching the other side of his cheek. He responded by whispering something back, his hand moving her hair back as his lips hovered closely to her ear. A man's voice called her from the other side of the room, and she pulled away. "I'll have to think it over," she said, a menacing gleam in her eyes, and spun off into the throng. Henry followed briskly, calling her name. "Venetia!" "And me? I was abandoned, alone in the middle of the room, mutely holding the plate of cheese straws in my hand. How could she do this to me? And why did he follow her? Doesn't he know that she's using him? That she says he's boring and his nose is like a giant wart? Doesn't he know she doesn't care a toss about anyone except herself, lining up the men to prove she's top? But worst of all, knowing how I love him, she revels in keeping him away from me, another of her little tricks at keeping everyone else beneath her, preening over us like she's some kind of vicious queen. It's not fair." She snaked her way through the throng to Mr. Slater, who was looking as impeccable as ever, his dark hair smoothed, a detached manliness about him making David and his friends look like half-wit schoolboys. Venetia's been fanatical, trying to get his attention. But he seems immune to her charms, possibly the first man ever. She's stepping up her game, or else she'll lose her bet with Angela. And Venetia always has to win. She calls herself the Empress of this little place, and she is determined to keep it that way. I wandered over to Daddy, who had dragged himself away from his office and was looking ferociously at Venetia, with Mrs. B prattling away beside him. He wants Venetia to marry Henry and inherit Brampton Hall, which is just plain ridiculous. I simply can't imagine them together, and even more horrible is the thought of Henry being my brother-in-law. Whenever we'd see each other, the tension would be insurmountable. But we would never give way to our secret passions, holding them inside like tragic lovers. Perhaps there'd be the occasional moment when we'd meet on the veranda. "Oh, Kitty," he'd say, surprised to see me. "Henry, I didn't think you'd be here," I'd reply, looking at the ground, then back towards the open French door, a white drape spilling out in the soft summer breeze.
"Nor I. I just have to say..."
"No, don't, Henry. Don't make things harder."
"But Kitty, darling..."
And so forth, until one of us dies. Daddy was muttering about Mr. Slater again.
"That Slater's a worthless coward for sitting out the war."
"Mr. Slater is exempt from fighting as he is flat-footed," Mrs. B told him pointedly. She's taken a fancy to Mr. Slater, imagining him a great artist ready for her to discover. Trying to prove herself frightfully cultured, she's attempting to take him under her wing. Heaven help him! Although I have no idea whether he's any good. I don't think Mrs. B has the ability to discern a masterpiece from a school art project.
"Slater's a down-and-out skiver, shirking his responsibilities."
Daddy gulped down his sherry.
"Cowardly laziness, that's what it's all about. He doesn't realise that it's fighting that makes a real man."
I thought of Edmund blown to bits in the North Sea, and poor David on the brink of a bullet in France, and couldn't help wondering if it had less to do with courage and more to do with common sense. Sending people off to their death seems completely ludicrous. I've begun imagining what it's like being blown up in a submarine. The radar blipping warning signals of one's approaching death. Everyone saluting and singing the national anthem. God save our gracious king. Then boom. Nothing. Only gnawed pieces of fingers and ears washing up on unsuspecting beaches. As I watched Mr. Slater, I couldn't help thinking that he can't be all bad. He helped Sylvie home last week when she came off Amadeus. She should never have tried to clear Bull's End Brook. It was lucky he was there. Although I wonder what he was doing at Bull's End Brook. It's the other side of Peaspotter Wood, the middle of the countryside. Daddy's eyes narrowed on Venetia, who was busy with Mr. Slater, all witty replies and feigned boredom. Even though Daddy will have words with her later, he can't control Venetia at all. Every time he tells her to leave Slater alone, she simply shrugs and smiles and says she's Daddy's little puppet, and then carries on as usual. It makes me sick. Henry was standing behind Venetia's shoulder protectively, trying to get into the conversation. He didn't have to try hard, as Mr. Slater seemed pleased to include him, speaking to him directly, making jokes as they both laughed. It was as if he was avoiding Venetia's attention. Henry put his hand on Venetia's arm, and I saw his eyes glance at her face, her throat, her cleavage beneath the low-cut dress. She shook off his hand, but he stayed close, and I wondered why he let her play games with him. But then I remembered how clever he is. He must be playing some kind of game himself. Then I realized I wasn't the only one watching Venetia. David Tilling was gazing over at her from the window, leaning against the wall, engulfed by her presence. He's been in love with Venetia since he was in breeches. I never thought it was so serious, but his eyes were like those of a big, gulping fish drinking her up. Venetia needs to watch herself there. David's become a lot more forthright since army training. Let's get the piano out, Mrs. Tilling called. Can I dare Kitty with a song or two? Mrs. Quayle, whose colour is a cheery orange, plumped her very ample behind on the piano stool, while Mrs. B grasped my elbow and marched me up beside her. Everyone knows I plan to be a singer when I grow up, so I'm always the first one called for a song or two. Prim gave me a special smile from the crowd, and I felt determined to make a good impression. Come on, Kitty! Everyone cheered, and I must confess I was touched and took the score. Mrs. Quayle had given me Green Sleeves, that beautiful song that was supposedly written by King Henry VIII, although I bet he asked someone to help him, as you can't be king and write lovely music at the same time, especially if you're busy beheading wives. Mrs. Quayle began the opening, and I entered with the wonderful tune. It was perfect for showing off my top notes. When I finished, Prim gave me a little nod as if to say, "Well done," and I felt a surge of delight. At long last, my skills have been noticed. I glanced over and caught Henry's eyes, and it was as if the world slowed down as our gaze met across the crowded room. He smiled, his whole face lit with joy and love, until Venetia nudged him with some remark or other. Trust her to interfere. In the next song, Gilbert and Sullivan's "I Am the Very Model of a Modern Major General," Mrs. Quayle started playing faster to trip me up on purpose. It was hilarious. "You should be on stage as a comedian, not a singer, Kitty," Hattie joked. Her colour is lilac, pretty and uplifting, and I have no idea why she's such good friends with vile Venetia and awful Angela Quayle. Perhaps she's trying to rescue them from utter loathsomeness. The pregnancy is making her tired. I could tell from her big brown eyes sagging with the weight of the evening. And yet she's always so lively, perking us up with her jokes and smiles. It must be difficult for her with Victor stuck on a ship in the Atlantic. I still can't get used to them being married. They were friends for years, and then, as if someone turned on a giant light. War was about to break out, and they fell in love, and got married within the week. It's happening everywhere, apparently. Obviously, it's all about death. How strange that love and death suddenly become so tightly knit in a time of war. Why everyone's getting married in a hurry? If you're in love, why wait for a tomorrow that never comes? People are being moved around, so if you want to stay with someone, you'd better marry them. Do you want to have children before it's all too late? Do you want to be notified when your someone special is killed? Do you want to get some money if they're killed in action? Do you want someone special to pray for, live for? Who will be left at the end after all? As we left, I gave David a peck on the cheek. Don't let Venetia get you down, I whispered, feeling the need to give him a word or two of support. You need to forget about her. Find someone who'll treat you right. He frowned at me. What are you saying, Kitty? He said, a cocky smirk coming over his mouth. Just because you're labouring after a lost cause, don't think we all are. I was shocked. The old David, the David before training, would never have said something like that. But I wasn't entirely sure I understood what he meant. Who exactly is the lost cause around here? Henry was leaving, so I had to forget all about that and rush off to steal a last moment with him. He was in the hall fetching his jacket, the special bomber pilot's one with leather and fur lining. When will I see you again? I asked, standing in front of him on my toes, my eyes level with his lips, soft and beckoning beneath his neat moustache. You'll see me, young lady, when we've fought off those Nazis, he said, taking my chin between his fingers. I tilted my face upward, closing my eyes, waiting for our lips to meet. But then Mama came through and said we had to go, so we were forced apart. There was a smile on his face as I pushed my arms through the sleeves of my coat and followed Mama and Sylvie out into the cold blackness outside. But as I turned to take one last look at him, he gave me a wink, and my heart exploded with joy, knowing only one truth. He loves me, and soon we will be together.
Mrs. Tilling's Journal. Wednesday, the 24th of April, 1940. Today, my son left for war. And I have adopted a brittle facade, a limp smile that wavers in and out like a broken tune on a worn-out wireless. I keep trembling as I remember the last war, all those soldiers who never returned. The neighbour's lad gone only a month before the telegram arrived. They say this war is different, but a horror overcomes me if I dare to think of David out there, trying to stay sane through the gore. They say we have bombers and tanks, and there won't be trenches like last time. But when I close my eyes, all I hear is the unbearable yells of men in pain, crushed by the colossal theatre of war. You see, I saw them come home after the last war. The cripples, the amputees. The ones so disturbed they'd never sleep soundly again, haunted by their dead friends, guilt-stricken that they were somehow allowed to live. They were never the same again. This morning was filled with much running up and down the stairs, the fresh scents of shampoo, hair cream and clean laundry cutting the fraught air. I watched out of the hall window for the van, as slow grey clouds mottled the outside world. Ralph Gibbs from the shop was leaving too, and Mrs. Gibbs was driving them both to Litchfield in her grocery van. "Look at you," I said as David came downstairs for the last time. He was wearing his uniform and looking all tidy and grown up. I straightened his already straight collar. I just wanted to touch him, to feel his mass under my fingertips. He looked down at me and grinned in his cheery way. "Well, best be off then, Mum," he said, "or I'll be in trouble before I've even started." He laughed a little, and I clenched my mouth into a tight smile so that I didn't cry. As he opened the front door, the clouds broke apart, and the sun came out, making the wet trees and grass glisten silently for a brief moment. Then a fine rain began, sprinkling the air with a dewy sparkle that made it feel almost unreal, like a slip in time. We said goodbye at the gate in the ethereal drizzle. With a glance back at the house, his home for all these years, he put his arms around me. I gripped him tight. "You know you don't have to go," I whimpered, praying for one insane moment that he'd change his mind. He smiled and wiped away a tear. "Chin up, Mum. Someone's got to teach those Jerrys a lesson, eh?" Pulling away, he ambled off to the van, and I studied his broad back, his lazy, lilting walk, his state of being that would no longer be mine to watch, mine to grasp. A vision came back to me of him as a boy, scampering down this very path, late for school, turning and grinning, lopsided by his heavy satchel. And just as I remembered, he turned back to me then, with that same look, as if the world were a great adventure for him to behold and relish. And I felt the rain washing the tears down my face for all our precious years together. He got into the van and opened the window to wave, and then, as it revved up and pulled away, his lips touched the palm of his hand and he blew me a kiss. Something he hasn't done since he was a child. It was as if on the edge of manhood he too remembered everything we had shared. That he was the man who was still, in his heart, my little boy, late for school. And then he was gone. I went into the house and moped around the kitchen, my head throbbing as it does so readily these days. I looked out of the window into the rain that still fell, the grass that still grew, the birds that still sung. But now I was alone. After a few dreadful minutes, I got up, unable to help creeping into his small, sparse room, still warm from his presence, running my hand down his soft blue bed cover. I remembered how many times I'd pulled it over his small frame at bedtime. And kneeling down next to the bed, I took a deep breath, filling my lungs with his essence, that unmistakable smell he's had since he was a baby. I'd recognize it anywhere, all salt and warm honey. That evening when I'd stopped crying, I realized that this was a feeling I was going to have to get used to, keeping busy, stopping my head from thinking the most abysmal things, never knowing where he is or whether he's still alive. David is all that I have. I know he must go and do his duty, even though I wish with every ounce of me that he might have been given a desk job or kept home to refuel planes. I can only pray that God is watching over him. I suppose I am just one of the millions of mothers around the world, standing by a door, watching our children walk down the road away from us, kit bag on backs, unsure if they'll ever return. We have prayer enough to light up the whole universe, like a thousand stars breathing life into our deepest fears. I had to pull myself together for tonight's choir practice, at once looking forward to expelling some pent-up feelings into the air, and also fearful that I'd collapse, breaking our silent vows to keep it tucked inside, keep spirits up. I went to the church early, wandering up to the altar and thinking about the finality of death. Then a hand on my arm made me turn around, and there was Prim, nodding her understanding. As if she knew, she saw straight inside me at the emptiness and fear. "Are you all right? Loneliness seems to follow me," I said with a sad smile. "It's never the end," she said softly. "Love is always there. You just need to embrace it." But I wasn't sure what she meant. Where is the love when my family have gone? You need to cherish your memories of people. You can't ask anything more from them now. The door squeaked open and Kitty and Sylvie dashed in, breaking up our talk with their chatter. Did David leave today? Kitty asked, breathless from running. Yes, I replied. He left this morning. Did he remember everything? I suppose so, I replied stiffly, not wanting to talk about it. Sylvie's little hand tucked into mine, and when I looked down I saw her eyes large and fraught. The poor child's seen far too much of this war. I can only pray it never comes here. Soon the choir stalls were packed, people clamoring to hear news of the war from anyone who knew anything. A few of us remained quiet, listening in a half-tuned-in way, as our thoughts were drawn away. Some of the women who also had loved ones away came to give me their sympathy, their scared eyes welcoming me into their haunted world. Prim turned to the choir, requesting that we sing Love Divine for Sunday. Gathering up the sleeves of her dramatic damask cloak, she held her baton high in readiness, and we plunged into it, bathing in the glow of song. At the end, Mrs. Quayle tottered to the front and had a word with Prim, to which she nodded and directed Mrs. Quayle back to the organ. By special request, we'll have a good old saying of the Lord's my shepherd. We gathered up our song sheets and looked towards her to begin. I knew Mrs. Quayle had done it for me. She knew it was one of my favourite hymns. I caught her eye to say thank you, and as the slow, methodical introduction began, I felt the blood pumping faster through my veins. The most beautiful sound. The choir in full voice was singing softly, hesitantly to begin with, and then opening our voices straight from our very hearts. The Lord's my shepherd, I'll not want. He makes me down to lie in pastures green. He leadeth me the quiet waters by. The volume swelled with passion and deliberation as we poured our emotions into every darkened corner of the church. Every dusty cloister and crevice reverberated, reaching a crescendo in the final chorus. A vocal unison of 13 villagers that cold, still night, pouring out our longings, our anxieties, our deepest fears.
Letter from Flight Lieutenant Henry Brampton Boyd to Venetia Winthrop. Airbase 9463, Dawes Hill, Buckinghamshire. Thursday, 25th of April, 1940. My darling Venetia, I have felt little except the wild beats of my heart since we parted last Tuesday. The way you looked, the way you moved in that dress, I feel mesmerized. Put under an enchanted spell by your elegance and beauty. When you told me that you would consider my offer of marriage, I could only rejoice in the knowledge that you might one day be mine. I only hope that I may survive this war long enough to know you properly as my wife. I am not due back to Chilbury until July, and when I arrive, I hope you might have had time to consider my proposal. I have plenty to offer, after all, my darling. Brampton Hall will be yours, as will our illustrious family name, and my everlasting passion and devotion. Timely weddings are usual these days, and I am anxious to be wed as soon as you give the word. They give the newly wedded an extra few days' leave. I have a good notion of the perfect place for our honeymoon, where we shall get to know each other in a wonderfully whole way. I truly cannot wait. Wishing you all my love, my darling, and hoping that while I am away, you remain mine, in the same way that I will remain completely and undeniably yours. Henry.
Letter from Venetia Winthrop to Angela Quayle. Chilbury Manor, Chilbury, Kent. Friday, the 26th of April, 1940. Dear Angela, so much to tell. First of all, you miss David Tilling's spectacular.